This is The Sweeper, the global football podcast with the best worldwide news and stories from the beautiful game, with Lee Wingate and Paul Watson.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we reflect on our trips to San Marino and New York, hear about the quickest goal scored in international football history, and talk through all the craziness of the US Open Cup first round. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Sweeper podcast with myself, Lee Wingate, and my fellow host, Paul Watson. It is a beautiful, beautiful time of the football calendar for us at the moment, with the first international window of the year taking place. We've had the brand new FIFA series, the Virgin Derby, the Basque Country in action against Uruguay, and the headline act, another throw of the dice for San Marino to end the longest winless run in international football history. They had a friendly doubleheader against St. Kitts and Nevis. You were there for the first game in Cerro Vale, Paul. How much do you regret it right now?
I don't regret it at all, actually. And I've got to say, what made it easier was to come back and see that the second one ended 0-0.
So the second one ended 0-0. That was a lot closer. The first one you were at ended 3-1. That was on the 20th of March. Let's perhaps talk through the action first things first. What was your take on the game?
The weird thing is, I actually would say that the second game was what I was expecting to see from the first one. So a tight 0-0 draw was my fear for this first game, because I'd seen San Marino play the Seychelles, where they were favourites to win. And what happened effectively was that they were fine at the back, very solid defensively, but what they weren't able to do was create opportunities and really run a game and dictate the pace of the game. But actually, I couldn't have been more wrong, in that what happened in this first game against St. Kitts and Nevis was that San Marino came out very fast and really started to get some joy, especially with some quite long balls down the San Marino left side, or St. Kitts and Nevis's right side, and started to really put a lot of pressure on the defence there. 21 minutes in, San Marino got a fairly soft penalty, which Filippo Berardi converted brilliantly. It was a fantastic penalty. And so we had this kind of unexpectedly exactly the opportunity that we'd hoped for San Marino was to be a goal up, because what we did believe San Marino could do was hold out a game defensively. They've shown they are pretty organised defensively. They're used to being under pressure. They're used to defending as best they can to keep the score down, but they're used to trying to basically withstand attacks. What I didn't think they could do was score goals. So after 20 minutes, we're all looking around thinking this could be the moment. Sadly, it really wasn't, in that what happened was St. Kitts and Nevis really upped a gear. It seemed to release something in them. And you could see suddenly the talent of some of these St. Kitts and Nevis players. The one who really sprung to mind was Tyrese Shade, who was just sensational on the ball, and just the pace he played at was amazing. But the whole, you know, this whole group of St. Kitts players suddenly just looked much stronger on the ball. They were creating problems for San Marino. And crucially, this was where San Marino's back line that we had highlighted could be a problem because of the new goalkeeper. That was where this problem really emerged, that San Marino had lost two goalkeepers in 48 hours. And that going into this game, they had an untested new goalkeeper coming in the form of Eduardo Colombo, and a back line that didn't quite know how to deal with that.
There seemed to be a very quick turnaround in this game. It all seemed to happen in that period directly before and after the break. And some of those goals were definitely defensive lapses, weren't they? They were pretty much gifts. And I wonder just how much the introduction of Eduardo Colombo sort of was to blame for that. I don't know if that's a bit of a harsh word, but he did seem at fault for one of those goals.
Yeah, he was at fault for one of the goals. And there was a moment before this where you could see it almost trailed, that some balls were coming into the box and there wasn't like a clear direction from the goalkeeper and there wasn't a clear direction from the defender. So you had this moment of uncertainty whenever the ball was being whipped across the box. And that immediately made you think, wait a minute, this team isn't going to deal with the kind of crosses that are coming over. And sure enough, it was two of those moments. Both goals, you could cite the goalkeeper as being at fault, but you also for one of them, certainly the defence also just did not deal with the ball coming across. And it's hard, you know, Eduardo Colombo, he's obviously, I think he's going to be a very talented goalkeeper. He's only 23. He came through Juventus's youth side. So this is a talented kid. But as we expected, partly him being thrown in for the first time and not having the safe pair of hands and the experience of Aldo Simoncini or Elia Benedettini, but also alongside that, having a new manager, Roberto Cervoli. So he hadn't even had any time really to get his vision for how this team should play across. And that's what it looked like. It looked like a team that were still remolding themselves. And to be fair, this is where I think a lot of credit goes to St. Kitts and Nevis. And we shouldn't make them the silent partners in this. You know, for us, we were very clear our motivation was San Marino, as is our want on this pod. But St. Kitts and Nevis really deserve a lot of credit for the way that they took this game on, and then having gone a goal down, rather than going to pieces or starting to think, oh, we're going to be the ones that lose San Marino, did quite the opposite. They really stepped up, reasserted themselves. And as I say, some of the speed at which some of these players were taking the ball and moving with it, just it was a different level at points to San Marino.
We didn't see so much of that speed and attacking intent in action in the second fixture on Sunday evening. I felt that was much more balanced. San Marino did look a lot more solid defensively, but unfortunately couldn't get the breakthrough. And so it ended 0-0. That means that their winless streak is now up to 138 games. That's 132 defeats, 6 draws, and only a fifth clean sheet in the last 2 decades. So I suppose that is some progress. But my next question is a sort of about St. Kitts, because they're ranked 147th in the FIFA rankings. That's 63 places above San Marino. And they've also beaten Saint-Martin, Saint-Martin, Aruba, Curaçao and French Guiana in the last year. Whereas San Marino, as I say, winless in 20 years, couldn't beat 167th ranked St. Lucia twice and couldn't beat 197th ranked Seychelles. Why did everyone think that this was such a likely opportunity to get a win?
I don't think we were that far wrong. I saw, you know, some of the sentiment in the aftermath was, well, people underestimated St. Kitts and Nevis. And I don't really think it was as much that. I think it was clear that they had some talented players, but they were also on quite a relatively poor streak for their standards. And it's more this unknown of how does CONCACAF match up to Europe, you know, to UEFA. Whereas within UEFA, you can fairly accurately say there are a lot of games San Marino will not win. So when we look at, you know, where's their next win going to come from? They will not beat Slovakia. You know, you can play this back to me when they do get this incredible win, but they will not beat Slovakia. They will not beat, you know, you can list all the names, but that isn't a realistic possibility. It was more the allure of the unknown here. But what was also really interesting, so I had the chance to speak to Sean White, who is the first vice president of the St. Kitts and Nevis Football Association, before the game. And lovely, welcoming, very eloquent speaker about football on his islands. I asked him, what made you take this on? Were you worried about being, you know, the team that lose to San Marino? And he quite nicely said, no, you know, we're not worried about it. If it happens, it happens. But we are pretty confident. And what for us appealed in this fixture is that there's a difficult balance to be met with St. Kitts and Nevis, so that they have players obviously back on the islands that are very talented, but they also have this European base of players, this European contingent that you saw in this game. You know, these are some of the players that really impressed in these two fixtures are actually European based players, and they don't often get the opportunity necessarily to make the case for their places. And the difficulty is blending the two, and that is, you know, this isn't unique to St. Kitts and Nevis. This is any team where there is, you know, a European based diaspora, and then there are people playing back in your home nation. There is this difficulty of giving both a fair shot at it. So these players coming into this were not sitting there thinking, oh God, are we going to lose to San Marino? They were probably just really psyched that they could get on the field, show what they're capable of in a game that was very likely to be winnable in their eyes. So I think, as I say, I don't think we necessarily were naive to the abilities of St. Kitts and Nevis. And I also don't think this wasn't a winnable opportunity, because the second game, San Marino really did peg them back a lot. And it felt like if they just had that one spark, if they'd got given that penalty they had in the first game, in the second one, possibly it'd be a different matter. But I do think also huge credit to Tsingits and Nevis for their attitude, for the way they took the game on. And yeah, I think, you know, they obviously have a lot of talented players.
It did seem a little bit like a who's who of content creators and in some cases famous people at the stadium. You were there with your comedian brother Mark Watson. We had Away Days presenter Ellis Platten, our friend the Tim Traveller. Everyone going there in the hope, I think, of seeing a moment of history. And then, of course, let's be honest, having the benefit of that for our various channels and podcasts to say we were there. Do you think there was an element of all-round disappointment from the content creator community at the game?
There very much was. There very much was. One reason I can't regret being there is it was absolutely lovely to meet all these people over this. You know, there's quite a funny scene playing out where we're having pizza in a bar in San Marino. And, you know, as you say, it's all these content creators and all these people who have followed the niche side of the game for so long. And we're there having this pizza and the San Marinese staff are pretty much unaware there's a match going on. And we've all descended upon this tiny stadium in this part of the world. And yeah, I think we were all disappointed. We all separately had said that our fear was that San Marino would win the second game, mm-hmm. having drawn the first one 0-0. And I think that was sort of a fear of mine, but I also would have just been happy because, you know, in the end, I think we just want them to win. So I would have got over the fact that I'd left San Marino 4 days before their victory if it had happened. But yeah, it was a lovely experience. It does bring on to this very interesting question, and where San Marino, I think, is quite unique, is that there just doesn't seem to be a home support, really, not a significant one. We've touched before about the Brigata Mai Una Gioia, the Never Any Joy Brigade, which is effectively the ultras, you know, this group of hardy fans who go to all San Marino's home games. It probably amounts to about somewhere between 5 and 20 people who kind of come in and out. They're all foreigners. They're all Italian. I mean, they're not hugely foreign, but they are Italians. There's a German in there. So that they are not San Marinese, and all the singing and all the chanting and all what we would associate with supporting your team is coming from there. And then alongside that, you can expect to see a lot of kids in the San Marino soccer school tracksuits who have come effectively as a school trip sort of feeling. So I'm sure they are supporting San Marino, but they are not necessarily there by choice. And then you have a scattering of San Marinese who do come, but it's a very small number of people, even compared to the population of the place. And you can walk around San Marino on match day and be pretty sure nobody is talking about that particularly. So it's a very interesting phenomenon that it feels like there's a passionate overseas fan base, but they're almost putting their own emotions into San Marino. And that's an interesting thing, because I spoke to a couple of San Marinese about this run and said, you know, could tonight be the night? And is this going to be a historic night for San Marino? And granted, I was doing this in Italian and maybe my Italian was so bad they were confused. But generally, their sentiments were, oh, yeah, it'd be nice if we won. But it wasn't, you know, the man and woman running the snack bar who realized we were English were just mystified. Said, what? Why are you here? We said, well, maybe San Marino will win tonight. And they were like, yeah, be nice. And I was like, you know, have you been coming for all these years? They say, yeah, yeah. I said, you know, does it seem exciting to you that they might win? And they're like, yeah, yeah. So to try and explain to them why right-minded, or probably not right-minded people, but why people have come from England to watch that is quite hard to explain.
There is such a strange contrast between the foreign enthusiasm and the muted home support, isn't there? But anyway, San Marino are next in action, as you say, against Slovakia. That's in Austria on the 5th of June. So I will be heading to that game. It's just down the road from Vienna at a stadium in Wiener Neustadt, which has a water slide in the background. So that's a sort of a unique quirk of football there. Then after that, they will be up against Cyprus. And then in September, they have the first game of this Nations League campaign against Liechtenstein, who have lost each of their last 24 games. It's the longest losing streak in international football in the world at the moment. Perhaps that will represent the best opportunity. And if they haven't won by then, Paul, I expect that you'll be back in Serravalle for the second time this calendar year.
We might both be there. We might take out a stronger sweeper contingent for this next one. But where does it stop? If they don't win that one, are we off to Gibraltar? You know, at some point, enough is enough.
Well, we'll have to decide. I think a few of the other content creators like Ellis Platton said, that's it, I'm giving up, I'm not doing it now. They'll just win without me. Tim might be going to the Liechtenstein game, actually. Hopefully we'll see him there. But anyway, San Marino didn't win this time. Hopefully they will very soon, and hopefully we will be there. Let's round up the rest of the international news now. There have been some great headlines from this March international window. We talked last time about the Basque country. They claimed a very respectable 1-1 draw against Uruguay in their first outing in 4 years. The British Virgin Islands scoring a late equaliser in the 98th minute to draw 1-1 with the US Virgin Islands in the sexless derby, the Virgin Derby, whatever you want to call it. Zambia lost to Zimbabwe in the end of the alphabet derby pool. I'm sure everyone will be really keen to hear about that. That ended 6-5 on penalties after a 2-2 draw, and I could not work out why a friendly had penalties.
Well, the end of the alphabet cup, clearly.
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah. How could I miss it? Any other results from this international break that stood out to you?
Andorra 1, South Africa 1 was pretty special, wasn't it? Because, you know, as with a lot of these FIFA series games, it was two teams you just didn't expect to see on the same pitch. But for then Andorra to lead very early on and then to get a 1-1 draw was a pretty amazing result. Even given the fact that Andorra, unlike San Marino, really have improved, you know, and there's really big strides being taken, that's a huge result for Andorra. And again, a great advert for FIFA series, really, for these games to be going on.
One more headline worth a mention in this international window was Austria beating neighbours Slovakia 2-0 in one of the shortest away days in international football. There's only 55 kilometres separating the capitals, Vienna and Bratislava. And producer Tom was among those making the hop across the border for a game that saw a piece of international football history. So here he is with a short report from Slovakia.
Hi guys, producer Tom here. I, on behalf of the other Bundesliga, the Austrian Football Channel, was in attendance, in a way, for the fastest ever international goal during this international window. The game was Slovakia against Austria, an international friendly, and now I wouldn't always travel for an international friendly. However, Vienna to Bratislava is just 55 kilometres away, I believe, making them the two closest capitals in Europe. So if you're coming over to Austria, it's a great place to go, actually. You can easily reach Czechia, Hungary. The easiest trip of all is Vienna to Bratislava. So that's what we did. We hopped down the Danube, less than an hour it takes to get there. We were having a lovely day, and then the sun went away, the storm clouds rolled in. We were outside the stadium, just in a pub, just next to the new stadium in Bratislava, ready to go in any time. And now I'm sure every football fan has experienced this at some point. We were in gate 104. We followed the signs for like 100 plus, went around, got to gate 103, and it is all cut off there. You cannot go from 103 to 104. And the people were saying like, no, you have to go all the way back round. You've got to go the whole way to get in. And we thought, oh. And they realised basically at that point that we weren't Slovakian and we were outside the away end. And then after a quick sort of confab between the security guards, they said, look, we can get you in the away end if you want. So by the time they sort of made some decisions and moved us up towards the stairs to get into the away end, we heard the unmistakable sound of a goal celebration. We were thinking, that can't be right. You know, look at the clock. It's like it's 6 o'clock on the dot. It can't be a goal celebration. But that sound, that unmistakable sound, it felt like it was. When we were getting the texts coming through saying Slovakia 0, Austria 1, before we'd got the notification for kickoff. I think it says a lot. We had to watch the goal on video. The play button and the sort of the grey bar at the bottom of the screen hadn't gone away yet. By the time the goal goes in, it was that fast. And I think there's a couple of things that make it an extra remarkable goal. Of course, it's already the fastest international goal ever, so that's remarkable in its own way. But the fact that Christoph Baumgartner picks the ball up from the centre and just darts forward, skips past three challenges and fires it into the bottom corner, that really is what makes it special. It wasn't just a dodgy back pass or the keeper being charged down or a defensive mistake. It was Baumgartner decisively darting forward from the centre. And he said at full time in the post-match interview, he said, yeah, we've been working on stuff like that, which I thought was quite amazing, really, to even think about doing that straight from kickoff. Well, like, why would you expect that that's going to work out? But it did. And then perhaps the even more amazing thing is that Florian Wirtz scored for Germany, Austria's rivals in a way, after 7.5 seconds in their game against France. So not only was that 7.5 seconds goal sort of forgotten, it was not even the fastest goal of the night. So an incredible goal from Baumgartner. Yes, a bummer that I was just outside and missed it, but still, nice to have some memories and some stories at least about that otherwise unremarkable game and the incredible 6-second goal from Christoph Baumgartner, who is definitely a player worth watching at the Euros this summer.
Well, how about that, Paul? The quickest goal in international football history. And all I can say is imagine being Florian Wirtz and scoring for Germany after 7.5 seconds, and it's not even the quickest goal of the night.
Yep, that is embarrassing. Oh, and I really feel for producer Tom there. That must be agony to be outside and hear the celebration. I've been in that situation in various regards, but never missed a goal that early in the game, obviously. But I have been in that position where I've been outside a stadium and heard something massive happen and I'm not able to get in. And it is a horrible feeling. So he'll always have that story of people saying, like, I saw the fastest goal ever. And people say, oh, really? Well, no, I heard it.
Well, actually, I'm not sure he would have seen it if he'd even been in the stadium, because I saw some photos and the away end at this stadium in Bratislava is horrendously designed. So there's like a big scoreboard coming down that basically, if you're sitting right near the back, it obscures your view of the final third of the pitch. So I'm not even sure he would have seen it anyway, to be fair. But anyway, thank you very much, producer Tom, for sending in that voice note. We'll take a quick break now and then we will come back to talk about some stories from the US and North America generally in part two. Welcome back to part two of this Sweeper podcast, in which we'll be switching our focus from the international window to North America, and in particular, the United States. Paul, I did, as I said I would on the last episode, I took my first ever transatlantic flight, took a taxi straight to my hotel, and headed straight up to the Bronx to see New York City FC take on Toronto FC at Yankee Stadium. And it will come as absolutely no surprise to you that I was totally wrecked by the end of it.
Yeah, it would have been so typical if you'd just fallen asleep in the seats and then been woken up by a caretaker sort of saying, game's over.
Yeah, I couldn't, because I had a very loud but very nice Argentinian journalist next to me. I actually had a great chat with him. He was a San Lorenzo fan. And I asked him which team he supported in Argentina. And he actually put his hand on my shoulder, looked me in the eyes and said, San Lorenzo is my team. It is now your team. And it is the Pope's team.
Wow, that's huge news.
Yeah, wow.
So San Lorenzo fan now, are you, I suppose?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Yeah. In South America, I've got Universidad de Chile from my Pro Evo days and now San Lorenzo from this Argentinian journalist. I'll tell you how I knew I was so tired heading to the stadium, because I was in the taxi. We had a lovely taxi driver from the Gambia. And I was so tired that I was chatting to him about football. And I started talking to him about how good Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is. So completely confused the Gambia and Gabon. And so his response was brilliant. He just said, no, my country is the one with the funny shape inside Senegal.
Brilliant. Little did he know as well that, like, in a normal day, you'd have been totally capable of like regaling him with your knowledge of Gambian football. But unfortunately, your brain had been addled by no sleep.
Absolutely fried. Anyway, the game itself was quite an interesting one. We had quite a lot of comments on Twitter when I said that I'd be going to this game, saying that you've picked a terrible match. Why are you going to Yankee Stadium? Why do you want to see New York City? It was more a case of, you know, I'm on holiday in New York, so I'm gonna pop along to the game. But actually, it ended up being quite a sweeper kind of game, because there are three teams in MLS from Canada, and I saw Toronto play against New York. And I think, you know, we've talked quite often about clubs that play in other countries. We've talked about Monaco in France, Vaduz in Switzerland. So actually, for us, the whole theme of teams from another country playing in a different domestic league is quite interesting. And then on top of that, we had the whole thing about it being played in a baseball stadium, because Yankee Stadium is a baseball stadium. And that was a super weird experience as well, because the grass, the pitch is the shape of a baseball field. And so the place that the press stand is located is probably perfect for baseball, because it'd be right behind the batsman. But in football, it just means you're a really long way away from the pitch. It was the furthest I've ever been from the pitch at a game.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but you're right. That would have been like prime location, right? But instead, you're almost like where you'd place the away fans or something. You're in the sort of the worst seats in the house in that way. It's a cool looking stadium, but like, is there also a lack of atmosphere because of the distance? Isn't it quite a big distance to the pitch for everyone because of the shape of a baseball field?
Now, I don't know if it's because it's a baseball stadium that the atmosphere is not so good. I think the attendance is just quite low. New York City FC aren't doing so well at the moment. You know, their days of having Andrea Pirlo and Frank Lampard are long gone. They did have a couple of names I recognise, but the stadium was actually only about a third full. It had an attendance of 18,600, which in a close to 50,000 capacity stadium was a bit disappointing. I did notice the atmosphere wasn't great, but then you sort of have all the enthusiasm and the lights and the commentary through the tannoys and everything that comes with US sports that sort of makes up for it a little bit. So I had a good time in the end. And I saw a few players that I did recognize on the Toronto team. So they had Lorenzo Insigne, Matty Longstaff, they had Federico Bernardeschi. So there were a few names there. And I did laugh because Insigne tried to catch the goalkeeper off his line from the center circle in the third minute. So he's just having great fun in North America, just trying to score from the halfway line. Toronto took a lead in the sixth minute, and then New York City came back and they won their first game of the MLS season. A lovely free kick from Santi Rodriguez. And then the winning goal was even better. This was a ball with the outside of the foot from Julian Fernandez, and it was headed right into the top corner by Kevin O'Toole. So it was an absolutely lovely goal. I was told before I went, you're not going to see much good football. And I saw two of the better goals I've seen live in sort of recent years.
That's really interesting. That sounds like a pretty class game. But like, so do you get the impression that was the fan culture, like, was it underwhelming? Because you say like the atmosphere is different because you have the PA system and you have sort of slightly Americanized version. But like comparing it to, say, when we went to, you know, Prague, I know that was a derby, it's a bit different. But like, is it a slightly sedate atmosphere at these kind of games?
Yeah, it feels different to some of the bigger games I've been to in Europe recently. So I've been to derbies in Madeira, Vienna and Prague this year. And I know they're all derbies, so that, as you say, they are different, but they felt a lot more intense. And this did feel like quite a relaxed atmosphere. I don't know if that's because they don't really have all that many away fans. I didn't see loads of away fans from Toronto. Could be down to that. But in any case, I had a pretty good time at this game. So now it just makes me keen, I think, to go back and experience some more MLS at perhaps more atmospheric stadiums. So if you are one of our US listeners, and we do have 15% of our listeners in the US, send us your MLS stadium recommendations to sweeperpod@gmail.com, and we'll try and get back stateside for another game soon. I did want to mention on this little segment about New York that there was another really quite interesting story from the other club in New York recently. That's New York Red Bulls. Tom Bogert, a US soccer journalist, tweeting, 15-year-old homegrown Julian Hall has been unable to be on the bench often this season because of New Jersey child labor laws. Kids under 16 can't work past 6 p.m. Today he's on the bench because it's a 2 p.m. kickoff, now subbing in for his season debut.
That's amazing. That's brilliant. Because, you know, we sometimes make those jokes about young players. It's like, oh, it's past their bedtime when they're in the Champions League. But it genuinely is. I'm sure those laws were not set up for footballers, but I'm sure they have a very important purpose.
Yeah, I just imagine him like looking at all the fixtures. When have I got an early afternoon game? When can I play? And the funny thing is, this game at 2 p.m. actually was the day before his 16th birthday, so he doesn't have to worry about it anymore.
So it was at 2 p.m. So it was that he had to stop work by what time? By 6?
Yeah, but most of the games are in the evening, so this was the exception. This was the one he could come off the bench for. But he did become the second youngest player to have ever featured in the MLS after Paul. Any ideas? He's quite famous. He was sort of a player that had huge potential and then never lived up to it at all.
Yeah, is it Freddie Adu?
It is, yeah. 14 years old he was.
You know, about every year, there's an article about what happened to Freddie Adu, isn't there? Like, because he was going to be the greatest, wasn't he? He was going to be like the Messi, America's Messi. Well, I suppose Messi probably wasn't Messi then, but he was like the big hope and just never made it. I never quite have the heart to click on the what happened to him. I hope he's okay.
Let's move on now to another topic. We're going to stick with the North American theme, but talk about the US Open Cup. Now, this is a competition we talked about in late 2023 when the brilliantly named Sharktopus FC got to within two rounds of qualifying for the 2024 tournament. And even though they didn't make it, there have still been some really cool stories for us to cover in the first round, haven't there?
Yes, and I follow quite a few accounts that do focus on US soccer. It's not one of my strongest suits. And just seeing some of the stories pop up, it's been absolutely brilliant, like some amazing headlines. And this tournament generally seems to really have that great spirit that, you know, is what we love about football, and sits very opposed to some of the more commercial elements of the US game.
Yeah, I think one thing that's made it even more exciting from sort of an underdog or outsider perspective this season is that there are actually only 8 MLS teams taking part. This is the first time there's been such a low number. And we have had a number of really, really good outsider stories. I think my favourite one is El Farolito. This is a club in the 4th division, an amateur team, who beat Portland Timbers reserve side 2-1 in the first round. And what makes El Farolito so interesting for us is that it actually takes its name from a Mexican restaurant and has a fan group called the Burrito Brava, which is just great stuff, isn't it? Like that, somebody, I think it was Men in Blazers on Twitter, they tweeted, would be like Nashville Reserves losing to Prince's Hot Chicken.
I love that. Now that's top sweeper stuff. There was also, was there not a game that had a really hilarious reason it was delayed, like a very sort of like double booked pitch or something?
Yeah, the Capo FC versus Dimuan Menes game that ended 2-2. Dimuan Menes won 5-4 on penalties, but that was delayed because the pitch was booked for a high school lacrosse match.
Again, you know, this is brilliant stuff. Real proper cup football.
But both of those had like really good side plots running to them. So the El Farolito one, the coach of the team is also one of the 3 general managers of the restaurant franchise. So his name is Santiago Lopez, and he helps run the restaurant and also coaches the football team, which is amazing.
That's fantastic.
El Farolito actually also won the US Open Cup in 1993 under another name. They were called Mexico CD at the time. And this was in the era between the NASL, the North American Soccer League, and the MLS. So the winner of the competition was actually the US soccer champion in that period of time. And yeah, El Farolito actually won the US Open Cup and then qualified for the 1994 CONCACAF Cup Winners' Cup, where they lost 5-1 to Mexicans Necaxa.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. See, these are all things that have passed me by over the years. I don't really know an awful lot about the US Open Cup, but the more I learn, the more I like it.
Yeah, it is a great competition. If we've missed out any really cool stories from the first round, then do send us an email to sweeperpod@gmail.com, because it seems to be one of those competitions that we keep coming back to. So yeah, if you're a US listener or you just follow the competition, let us know about any more upsets that you think we should mention. But I think for now, that's about it for this episode. We've got a Patreon episode that you can listen to right now. We've got 3 stories from the UK and 3 stories from the rest of the world. Paul, what are the UK stories for this episode?
We have one of the most disastrous debuts in history from a goalkeeper, and we have a huge scoreline in a women's match, and we also have the story that we touched upon last year a little bit about Alderney, the Channel Island, looking to end their 103-year losing streak.
Yes, and we actually have a voice note from the Alderney captain, so you can hear that on our Patreon episode. In addition to the rest of the world segment, we have the 58-year-old ex-chairman of Shanghai Shenhua scoring in the Chinese Cup. We have a clean-up ceremony to banish bad results by Peruvian team Deportivo Garcilaso. And we have an Indonesian version of Rory Delap as well. So all of that you can listen to at patreon.com/sweeperpod and help support the pod at the same time. So you can listen to that now. Otherwise, we'll be back with another episode on Wednesday, the 3rd of April.